The oil was really clogged up there for a while.
We are looking at 4 months of losing at least 90% of the overall transits.
The Iran deal that we made is going to bring a lot of success to the world.
Take it at face value and assuming it gets executed, you'll start to see movement coming out of the strait and you'll start to see prices come down.
A deal has been signed between the US and Iran, but the clock is now ticking and everybody's asking, what will it cost?
And it's been a months-long war that has spiked not only oil prices, but also anxieties around the world. We really want to know who's going to pay that tab. Welcome to The Dip. I'm Cassandra.
And I'm Daniel. And Cassandra, it's a memorandum of understanding rather than exactly a deal. So what are we understanding about this memorandum?
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's more of a memorandum of misunderstanding with some of these things, because it's 14 points and that sounds like a lot. But basically it means that they have an agreement to keep talking, that they've kind of agreed upon the playground or the sand pit that they're now going to be working within, right? But President Trump does seem pretty chuffed with himself, I do have to say. Let's take a listen to what he had to say earlier this week.
The Iran deal that we made is going to bring a lot of success to the world, because the oil was really clogged up there for a while.
But Daniel, we saw how long it took to get to this framework of a deal, right? Just that part, since this ceasefire with only moderate attacks on each other, that took over 60 days. So what's possible to get done in what is now going to be a 60-day period in which they're making some hard decisions? That really is going to be the difficult thing to answer, right? So I'm going to get a little bit nerdy here for a second and talk about some of the points.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. from the MOU. So we had point 4. That was about the removal of the naval blockade. And it's about the return of traffic to pre-war levels, right? Making sure we get a lot of ships moving through the strait once again. Point 5 says that there would be no charge for 60 days in the strait. So this is this like toll point. But prior to the war, there was no toll or charge. So that one's a little bit confusing to me, I have to say. And there's also the figure in this plan that's jumped out to a lot of people in our circles. It was a topic of conversation in the newsroom today, which was
$300 billion, right?
$300 billion, right? Which is so much money. But let me back up. It blew my mind, because what it's about is the U.S. working with regional partners to make sure that there's an investment plan to help rebuild the infrastructure and the economy of Iran. I'm not sure who's writing that check, so to speak, so far, but that also has to be decided within the 60-day window. And one last one, it's a waiver for the export of Iranian crude oil, basically a waiver for sanctions, as I understand it. But there's a lot to get into, but a lot of it is affecting the money and the economy, especially for Iran right now.
Yeah, and we don't know what's exactly going to happen with this. So it could be that even by the time that you're listening to it, that everything's fallen apart, because we know that the three men at the center of this, it's a U.S.-Iran deal, but also it clearly involves Israel as
That's
well.
Right.
I mean, it says in the document itself about that the fact that it includes Lebanon, that Lebanon has to be protected in this period. No more bombing of Lebanon.
From Israel.
From Israel.
Yeah.
So that's something that Benjamin Netanyahu is not party to this deal, has to stick by.
Yep.
So we've got Benjamin Netanyahu, we've got Donald Trump, we've got Khomeini as well.
Yep.
Can all of these men stick to what they've promised? And we know from Donald Trump specifically, he's famous. On Wall Street even, the traders are famous for, Taco Trump. Trump
exactly.
Always chickens out. Will he back out of the deal? Will he make statements contrary to the deal in order to put pressure on Iran? That's what he's done in the past. And it could well happen again. And 60 days in order to hold things together and for everyone to just be calm and carry on.
And answer these hard questions.
And to answer these hard questions, these are not easy questions, especially when it comes to things like the nuclear deal and winding it all back down and all of this and all of the... I mean, it says here, the United States of America undertakes to terminate all types of sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, that's subject to negotiations, but how long that takes, how difficult that's going to be, remains to be seen. But we have people who can tell you a lot more about it than we know ourselves. I mean, joining me now are two people who know the story from the inside. So if there is a big oil tanker on the water, David Vesh probably knows where it's been and where it's going. David, welcome. And also Richard Nephew, who was on the US team that negotiated the Obama-era Iran deal. Richard, thanks for joining us. And Richard, I would start with you, actually. The Trump administration now has to hammer out the details with Tehran. And you've been in those rooms. What are these negotiations actually going to be like?
Well, look, I suspect that, you know, at least some of the terms are already stated and some of the terms are already known because we see them in the MOU, right? You were just pointing to the idea that all sanctions are to be terminated. That's pretty declarative language. Whether or not the president can actually do that constitutionally and based on the legislation exists is a separate matter. He's made that commitment already. And there are people in the United States right now who are pointing to similar commitments made by the Iranians in terms of what will happen with the highly enriched uranium and so forth. So I think that the negotiations about implementation of the MOU are more likely to be about timing. They're about to be specifics, you know, where more money is potentially going to go, you know, when transactions are going to take place, that sort of thing. The bigger issue is this longer term deal. And there's a lot more complexity that has to come into this, especially if the U.S. is trying to try and hold the line on some of the things President Trump has said about what the Iranians will do on the nuclear program.
Okay, Richard, we know that this has had a massive impact on the world economy, of course, because the Strait of Hormuz is where a lot of oil comes from. It's had a massive effect on the oil price itself. So when you look at this memorandum of understanding, which points stand out to you as something which could dial things down a bit, you know, relieve some of the tension on the global economy?
Well, certainly the removal of the blockade is at the top of the list, along with Iran's commitment to relax its control over the strait. And I use that word advisedly because, you know, there is language in here that would still potentially allow the Iranians to exercise administrative control over the strait. And that potentially could be used to regulate who's allowed to come and who's allowed to go. I also think, you know, as you're just pointing to, one of the most significant pieces here is that this is going to relax sanctions on Iran's ability to export oil, including all of the sanctions that would cover its ability to gain access to those revenues. So, you know, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow because of the difficulties in opening the strait, the possibility there are still mines, the uncertainties that exist as to how long this will stick around. But, you know, take it at face value and assuming it gets executed, you'll start to see movement coming out of the strait and you'll start to see prices come down. The real question is whether or not this is a cost that's worth paying, considering the Iranians are getting a lot here and without committing a lot on the nuclear side, much less missiles and other things.
Well, I mean, that's a good point, David. Do you think, okay, there's 30 days to open up the strait, but there's a lot of complexities involved in that. And at the moment, it is risky to move through the strait because of all of those mines that Richard was mentioning. Do the clients and you and the people that you talk to in the energy industry, are they willing to take that risk?
I think that is different from a case-to-case basis. We have actually observed a significant increase in the transits through the Strait of Hormuz over the last 2 to 3 weeks.
So is that why we didn't see $200 a barrel, because there was some movement out of the Strait of Hormuz?
No, that's definitely not the case. I mean, it's a fact that we have for nearly four months lost most of the transits. There have been some transits all the time, but we're talking here about basically 10% or so of the original level. Yeah? So that helps a bit, but it does not solve the overall problem. The overall problem has been solved by the other factors. The big factors why oil prices have not fallen much more is that the market has released a lot of oil from storage in different places, including the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We have also seen very strong supply from all over the Americas, Argentina, Brazil, Canada, Venezuela, even the US. And then the most important single factor is that China has curtailed its imports over the last couple of months drastically. That has taken a lot of pressure from the market, and that is why consumers have been spared this much higher prices a lot of analysts have been expecting.
I will ask you about China in a second, because I think that's a really interesting thread, David. But one of the things that stuck in my head about this MOU is this idea of a toll, right? That for now, for the next 60 days, there will not be a toll. What happens after 60 days, who's to say? But I just want to play one quick soundbite. This would be when President Trump was in a bilateral meeting with the fresh French president, Emmanuel Macron.
We have an agreement where it's going to be open, and it's toll-free. We had a little argument on that. It's toll-free.
So, David, is the possibility of a toll a win for Iran?
Yeah, of course. I mean, if they can make extra income of one of the most important trade routes in the world, then that would be a huge income, and it would be a drastic change to the status before. Of course, it raises the questions what the other countries in the region think, because it's clear that ultimately the toll has to be paid by the exporting countries in the region, because no consumer would be willing to pay extra because oil has passed through the Strait of Hormuz. They can also buy in the Americas or in West Africa and don't have to pay such a toll.
And in terms of looking forward, right, David, what do you think? Do you think oil prices are going to continue to fall? We're in, as of recording anyway, like the low 70s or so. There's been a big drop off since this deal, or, you know, understanding of a deal was unveiled over the course of this week. Do you think that prices are going to continue to fall, or will China or other countries that you mentioned that were releasing stocks, are they maybe going to be trying to replenish stocks in the not too distant future?
Yeah, there's overall quite some disagreement on the path of prices. I think one thing is clear, it's not a smooth sailing with lower, lower, lower prices. There is an incentive, as you mentioned, for a lot of countries to rebuild stocks. There is also still a very, how to say, overall short supply situation. So a lot of people will try at lower prices, even more than over the last 2 months, to get new supplies, replacement supplies. So I think there is definitely the opportunity for some upside in prices in the medium term. But my personal takeaway from the last 4 months is that there has been already before the crisis much more supply than I have thought, and that has only grown. So I think overall the likely pattern for the next couple of years is ample oil supplies based on all the developments in the Americas and in other parts of the world.
Something that jumped out to me as I started following this story was this $300 billion figure that we mentioned earlier that's supposed to go towards rehabilitation and economic development. But I'm a little fuzzy on what that could even look like. Richard, how do you imagine that this fund would be implemented?
Well, I think the first thing to emphasize is that, at least according to the MOU, this doesn't actually get triggered unless we're in a final deal. I think that in a way, it's similar to other reconstruction funds that have been talked about for Gaza or talked about for Yemen, for instance. You know, so you can have a little bit of skepticism that it'll actually end up happening. But I think that the theory is that there will be investments that will be made in civil infrastructure inside of Iran, that this won't be, you know, a $300 billion fund that Iran will be able to just withdraw from as it wishes. Instead, it'll be something that'll be linked to specific projects, potentially to specific activities and partners that will say, I am prepared to build a desalination plant over here. I am prepared to help rebuild a port. And that will, in aggregate, end up being, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 billion. Again, assuming that this actually gets to a final deal, of which I've got some skepticism.
And it sounds like 60 days is not very much time.
Yeah, look, you could negotiate a comprehensive deal in 60 days if you're prepared to use a lot of the language and terms and concepts from the old Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal from 2015. You know, there are words there that still work as technical language that you could harvest. I think the bigger problem is that there are fundamental demands that are being made that are just hard to reconcile. The United States is saying Iran shouldn't have a significant nuclear program. The Iranians are saying they should. You know, right, that right there gets you a lot of difficulty, especially if you're trying to overcome, you know, pretty hard and fast political positions that have been taken, whether by the United States or by the Iranians. And then, of course, you got the problem of spoilers that potentially will come into all that, too.
Okay, and Richard, you've been in the oil-loving state of Texas this week. What are you hearing from energy insiders there and also in the U.S. in general?
So generally speaking, you know, people are optimistic that over the long term that there is going to be an unsticking of the oil market. But there was a lot of caution there, too. You know, I think people were a little skeptical about the terms. They were worried about whether or not this is a deal that'll be sustainable, especially in the context of the linkages that are being made here, not just to the nuclear issue, but also to, you know, places like Lebanon and other countries having a lot of potential control over whether or not a deal were to be continued. I think there was also a lot of realism about how long it'll take to get the strait reopened and, you know, whether or not, you know, there are a lot of mines being a complication, whether or not Iran is going to execute an administrative control over the strait and over the passage. And certainly just, you know, plain, you know, business decisions that have to be made about how many ships people want to potentially risk losing back up in the northern part of the Persian Gulf if hostilities were to restart.
So a lot of questions from here in the room, the spiritual room of the three of us. But the administration is trying to paint this as a win, right? Let's hear a little bit from the U.S. Vice President, J.D. Vance.
I think it's a great day for the American people because what this deal does fundamentally is two things. It immediately reopens the Straits of Hormuz. We're already seeing in the past 24 hours more traffic flow. You see oil prices coming down. But you also have the long-term commitment that Iran will never develop or procure a nuclear weapon. Those are two very big wins for the American people.
All right. So, Richard, after all of this is said and done, was this whole project campaign from Trump, from the U.S. administration, was it worth it?
In my opinion, no. The win that he is speaking to there is that the Strait of Hormuz is as open as it was back in February. And I know that's become a major talking point of people who are critical of this MOU, but I think it's a fact that just needs to be maintained. So then you have to evaluate this against what are the other accomplishments. And based on everything that we have heard thus far, Iran still retains a missile program. Frankly, the president endorsed the idea that they'll continue to have a missile program going forward. They still have highly enriched uranium. This deal does not actually guarantee that goes anywhere. It's something that will happen in the future, assuming we get to a more comprehensive deal. So from the demand side, there's not a lot here. But then we have to look at the give side. And, you know, frankly, the Iranians are getting a really good deal. They are getting the strait back open. They're getting the ability to ship oil themselves without sanctions. They're getting access to unfrozen assets. And they're also getting essentially the United States saying, we're not going to go to war with you again. And a marked reluctance, I think, that'll come forward with that, too. So anyway, to me, this all adds up to something that certainly you could argue there was damage that was done. You could argue that there are new people who are physically in charge. But does this change the fundamental character of the Iranian government? No, that was a thing the United States wanted to achieve. And in the meantime, we've got the Iranians simply having a much larger pot of money that they can play with.
Okay, I was going to go into some sort of deep analysis of your personal theory on sanctions, but just even looking at the title of your book, The Art of Sanctions, says a lot about how you feel about sanctions themselves, that it is an art. It is a balancing act. It is something that you can't just charge in there and just do how you feel. And in that book, you mentioned that there are two factors, pain and resolve, which have to be weighed in the balance. And in fact, it says a lot also about the Obama administration's approach to sanctions against Iran, which was careful to make sure that there was not blowback on both the US and allies. What happened this time round and how is it different?
I think the reality is they came against what the Iranians had determined were their bottom lines, that they weren't going to give away their nuclear program. They weren't going to give away their missile program. They weren't going to give away, you know, who was leading the country. And that basically they said, if you want to be successful, if this is what you want to do, you're going to have to massively increase your own pressure, including, you know, boots on the ground, those sorts of things. And the United States was just unwilling to do it. So to my mind, the theory of the pain resolve math is still very much there. In this case, the United States was unwilling to escalate as far as it would take to overcome Iranian resolution and their willingness to stick around and to push back.
You know, I want to stick with the art of the sanction or the art of sanctions here for a second, Richard, because you were part of the team negotiating the JCPOA that basically got called weak sauce by Republicans at the time, right? And now you're watching this MOU be unveiled and signed with the Iranians that essentially, from my view, grants more concessions than the JCPOA did, and it's being called a victory. Like, do you feel like you're taking crazy pills, or what's that been like for you?
Well, I will admit to a massive amount of frustration on that. And especially, you know, when, you know, some of the rhetoric that came along with the JCPOA as to what the concessions we were giving and how it was going to, you know, lead to the destruction of Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so, you know, the inflamed rhetoric from the JCPOA timeframe was really unworthy of the people who are making otherwise, you know, you could argue reasonable technical arguments. But I think when you look at this deal, I think two things stand out. One, finally, people who were opposed to the JCPOA recognized that it wasn't us giving away things, but rather a result of the need for a compromise in a negotiation. And you hear a lot of people making talking points now and talking on the news about, well, we couldn't get everything we wanted. Yeah. Yeah, that's a thing that happens in negotiations, folks. And, you know, you have to give to get. I think the other thing that stands out is, you know, this isn't the JCPOA. We didn't get significant nuclear concessions. We didn't get concessions on you know, key areas of concern with Iran's nuclear program, let alone all these other things that were being set out. But we are giving away a lot. And I actually think that the comparison is to the Joint Plan of Action, which preceded the comprehensive deal, was in place while we were negotiating. It's the same concept here. And, you know, we are in this MOU getting far less in terms of controls on Iran's nuclear program, far less in terms of access for the international inspectors. And at the same time, even if you take aside that $300 billion fund that may never exist, we're giving away a lot in terms of sanctions relief. So, you know, ultimately, this is far more concessional. And it doesn't position us, in my opinion, well to try and get to a comprehensive deal, because the Iranians are getting a lot already without having to give a lot.
And I think looking at the kind of signal to noise ratio in the Obama era versus Trump, and I'm not taking a cheap shot at Trump here, but I think Obama was very willing to say nothing and to give targeted communication where necessary in coordination with his negotiation teams. Trump seems to be someone who will say things off the cuff, will say what he feels, and also he's very much willing to put public pressure on whichever negotiating party he's dealing with. It makes it kind of difficult to work out what he means, what he wants, and what the status of the negotiations are actually at. What are you looking for from these various parties going ahead in the conversations that they're going to have to get some sort of signal out of that noise?
Yeah, I definitely think this is an issue. And I think his lack of message discipline has been a real problem for U.S. negotiators. I mean, the reality is that repeatedly he said we were going to attack Iran if they didn't make concessions. They didn't make concessions. We didn't attack Iran. I mean, those are the sorts of things that you shouldn't bandy about if you don't want to diminish your own position and your own leverage. And, you know, in the past, you know, people I've worked for have said words like big nations don't bluff. Well, in this case, you really shouldn't bluff in a negotiation when the other side can call you out, is prepared to call you out. I think, you know, going forward, I fully expect the president will continue to have this message in discipline. It's going to be a problem. I think he's going to make demands and make statements that are going to make it harder for U.S. negotiators to actually try and get to conclusions here. The fact he's already given away, in theory, that Iran could have enrichment going forward, that Iran could have missiles. I mean, again, all these things he was going to have to give away anyway. But if the U.S. negotiating position going into a final deal was to try and limit them, well, the president is who the Iranians can point to and say is already accepted things. And then I think the last big thing is the Iranians are themselves going to have to deal with the fact they've got internal politics and disagreements. And so, you know, the real issue you're going to see there is whether or not they can control that internally. But I don't think that you're going to hear as much in the public discourse, at least from authoritative people. You're going to hear more from people who are outside of the system. The biggest factor in all this, I think, is going to be where the Israelis are. And certainly where things develop in Lebanon in particular, you know, how Hezbollah and the Israelis, you know, interact, whether or not they go back to war. Those are the sorts of things that I worry about, too, looking to the longer term negotiation.
Can you believe it? But that's all we have time for on The Dip.
That's right. And if you have any questions or comments, go ahead and leave them wherever you're listening or watching this episode right now.
Did you know we have email?
Ooh.
It's thedip@dw.com if you want to get in touch with us.
And until next time, thank you so much for watching The Dip.
Thank you.
Dip.
Bye for now.
Dip.
See ya.